This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm really pleased to have in the studio with me Garrett Graff. He's the author of The Threat Matrix and now a new book, Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. His website is Garrett Graff, GarrettGraff.com, and you can tweet him at VermontGMG. And GMG?
Yep.
Garrett M. Graff?
Yep.
Okay, Garrett, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to the studio. Pull that microphone about 3 inches closer to you and it'll work a whole lot better. Tell me about the Designated Survivor Program.
So this book is the history of what are known as the continuity of government plans, or all of the weird stuff that would have happened during and after a nuclear attack. And then how the U.S. would have planned to rebuild and restart the country, the government, and our society.
So presumably all this came out of the Cold War, post-1950, basically.
So these plans began under Harry Truman, came up to present day. They still exist. Raven Rock, the title of the book, is the back of Pentagon bunker in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, about 90 minutes north of us here in Washington. That is literally a hollowed out mountain. It is a bunker that could hold several thousand people, built in the 1940s and 1950s, and is a freestanding city inside of this mountain. I mean, everything
still active.
Still active.
Are there people living there?
There, not no one lives there, but it's staffed. I mean, there are three shifts a day that come through that, 24 hours a day. 365 days a year.
I remember hearing about this when I was a kid. I mean, literally back in the 50s and 60s when I was a kid. And it was always, we were always told that there's this secret city and, you know, for the, all the politicians to flee to, and it's near Washington, but the location is top secret. Yep. How long has the location of Raven Rock been known?
Well, so there are two of these, actually. There's Raven Rock in Pennsylvania, which is the Pentagon bunker. And then Mount Weather, which is the civilian government bunker, where the president, where the cabinet, where the Supreme Court, other government agencies.
And that's near D.C. also.
And that's about 80 minutes west of us in Berryville, Virginia. But they were part of, so those two still active today, still staffed today. But during the Cold War, there were more than 100 of these facilities scattered around Washington. One for basically every single government agency and department. So the State Department was going to go to this very bucolic cattle research farm in Front Royal, Virginia. The Federal Reserve had a bunker in Mount Pony, Virginia, down by Richmond, that had room both for its Fed chair, the Board of Governors, but then also held $4 billion in cash. That would have been the money that the country could have restarted its economy with after a nuclear attack.
Wow. And when did this stuff go public?
So this has been trickling out, since the very first days of the Cold War. But this was this book is really the first attempt to bring it all together. All of these little tidbits that that people have learned, little declassified documents that have trickled out over the years. Raven Rock and Mount Weather still considered secret facilities, sort of in the way that like Area 51 is. It's an acknowledged government facility, but no one gets to go inside, and we don't really know.
They don't do guided tours.
They don't do guided tours. Yeah,
and I'm assuming they'll shoot you if you try to take one.
And in fact, as part of this, someone who was doing a piece on the book actually went up and tried to drive by Mount Weather, and was ushered away by the Mount Weather police.
Oh, wow, amazing! So tell me about the post office's role in this, particularly in this era where we've got the bright new idea of the Republican Party, which started in 2006 when they put this thing into law that if you're a postal, that the post office had to set aside $5 billion a year for the next 10 years to fund the retirement health expenses of people who had not yet been born.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a naked attempt to kneecap the post office so that FedEx and UPS, you know, their lobbyists had been hard at work so they could pick up all that business. So at the same time that the Republicans are trying to privatize the post office has actually got a lot of responsibility in this.
Yeah, and this is where this these plans are just so wacky and unexpected, where, you know, there's one set of this that deals with the literal minutes and hours around a nuclear attack. I mean, how the president would command our nuclear system, launch nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's a whole other set of these plans about how the government would begin to rebuild. And so each government agency had, during the Cold War, a post-apocalyptic version of itself. And the post office was the agency through the Cold War that would have actually been in charge of registering the dead and figuring out who was left alive in the United States, because the post office had access and records of where people lived. The Department of Agriculture and would have been in charge of feeding the country, the rations and what food would have been in the fallout shelters. The IRS had all of its plans for how they would levy taxes on nuclear damaged property. But then these plans still exist in modern form with updated threats. So the post office isn't in charge of registering the dead. They are, though, the agency today tasked with distributing medical countermeasures in the event of a biological chemical attack or a public health pandemic. Mm. And so,
which actually makes a lot of sense.
Which makes a lot of sense. The post office is the only government agency that can touch every American's house in a given day. Right. And so,
and does.
And so there's a very detailed plan about how the post office would be given the Ebola vaccine or an anthrax anecdote and be able to go out and distribute that in affected regions or even the entire country in the course of a day.
Right. And then the president has a doomsday airplane that's on standby 24/7.
24/7. So as we are sitting here today,
this is not Air Force One.
Not Air Force One. This is a dedicated plane known as the Night Watch planes. These are four converted 747s. As we're sitting here right now, one of these planes is on the runway at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. Its engines are on. It is fully staffed with everyone that you would need to lead nuclear war. And it could take off in under 15 minutes and rendezvous with the president wherever he is and help him lead and run a nuclear war for 3 days.
Did that plane take off on 9/11?
So it did, and it's a very interesting story because it was on that day based at Andrews Air Force Base right here in Washington. And it took off in the minutes after 9/11, the attacks first happened, and was part of the very initial moments of utter confusion because people saw this plane flying low over Washington. And that was what is believed to have caused some of the evacuation of the White House and other buildings as people saw this unexpected and unexplained plane flying over Washington, D.C.
Remarkable. We just have a minute or so left. Before we're going to hit an absolute heartbreak. If our federal government is planning this carefully for nuclear war, does that increase the probability of nuclear war?
So it's a fascinating part of this history because it's almost the opposite. It's that there's all of these interesting anecdotes that I tell in the book of presidents going through these exercises. I mean, really wrestling for the first time with how bad nuclear war would be. And I think it actually caused the opposite reaction, which was presidents went up in these doomsday planes, ran through nuclear war exercises, and were very chastened by that experience.
Any evidence that experience has happened to Donald Trump?
No. He has been briefed on these plans. He has said that he has found that a sobering experience, but he has not been through these exercises at least that we know of.
Wow, that's remarkable. And tell me about the D-minus plan and the plan C.
So these were the plans during the Cold War for what would happen after a nuclear attack, including basically the presidential dictatorship that would take over in the wake of a nuclear attack. The suspension of habeas corpus, the declaration of martial law, the J. Edgar Hoover's list of subversives who would be rounded up after the signing of what was known as the Master Arrest Warrant.
Are they still compiling lists of people to arrest?
So we don't know how much of these Cold War plans have modern analogs, but we do know that plans like the Patriot Act were pre-written in the event of an emergency, and that there is this draft legislation sitting in safes in Washington, ready to be unveiled in the event of an emergency. And we don't really know what all of those plans are.
It would cause America to cease to be a democracy and essentially become a kingdom, at least over a temporary period of time.
Yeah.
And the Patriot Act, I remember when it was rolled out, you know, after 9/11, everybody was like, where the hell did this come from? Oh, no, this has been around for a long time. How far back does that go?
These go back all the way into the 1950s. There is a draft piece of legislation known as the Defense Resources Act that is entirely pre-written, sits in safes around Washington, has been updated repeatedly, never technically introduced in Congress, but we know it's just sitting there with this set of emergency powers for how to remake the country in the event of some sort of catastrophic emergency.
So could Trump, if there was, you know, you said in the event of a catastrophic emergency, they're envisioning nuclear war, but what if it was, you know, a dirty bomb in lower Manhattan that causes 30 square blocks to be shut down for the next 100 years? Would that be enough for Trump to say, okay, that's it, no more democracy in America, and by the way, we're rounding up, 100,000 activists?
A presidential emergency is whatever a president declares it to be. And
So Bush could have conceivably even done this with 9/11.
Where these plans get really strange is we don't have a good sense. The most secret set of these plans is known as Enduring Constitutional Government, ECG. And that's how the three branches of government would work together in an emergency like this. And we don't really know what those plans entail, when they could be activated, and for how long they would operate.
Amazing stuff. The book is Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. The author, Garrett M. Graff. He's also the author of The Threat Matrix. Garrett, thanks for dropping by.
My pleasure.
Great having you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can tweet Garrett at VermontGMG and his website, Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Graff, G-R-A-F-F.com, the book Raven Rock. And welcome back. Will in San Francisco, California. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I'm thinking to myself, you know, why do people buy into this Republican, you know, a theory, right? It's an ideology. And everyone's talking about the Democrats needing a message. Well, they need to create their own philosophy, their own theory. And I think in the past when they've done it, it worked. But it's missing. There's no philosophy that people can rally behind. You know, if you were to say, what is it mean to be a Republican? Well, obviously, tax cuts, you know, less government, less regulation. I mean, they're just words, empty words, but at least people know exactly what it means, you know?
Actually, I think people don't know what it means. I think the average person thinks that means something good for them, when in fact, government is the only force that can hold back giant corporations and billionaires. So all those things you just described, Will, are things that are good for billionaires and bad for the rest of America.
I agree 100%, but they've ingrained that theory into the psyche of Americans. Mm-hmm. And my thought is, you know, what is it? What is the democratic theory? And I think they need to start messaging, we are for good, responsive, honest government. You know, for all. It's, you know, people hear the Democratic Party and they're not here listening, like, in their own head what it means to be a Democrat. Good, honest, responsive government. You know, I don't know. I don't know how you fight back this Republican ideology without one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, Will. I mean, what has happened is it's basically a triumph of marketing. Prior to the Reagan era, the Republican message was, and certainly the Republican message of both Nixon and Eisenhower, was, you know, we're pretty much like the Democrats. We think that, you know, Social Security is a good thing. We think that having a social safety net is a good thing. We are okay with labor unions. We're not happy with them, but we're okay with them. Eisenhower actually bragged in his reelection in 1956 about how he had added over 1 million people to union rolls, over 1 million people to the Social Security, rolls, et cetera, et cetera. But with Reagan, that was basically the takeover of the libertarians, what we would today call the Koch network. And their whole thing was, we need to stop the ability of government to restrain the behavior, the political behavior of billionaires and the political and economic behavior of big corporations. And so I would say that what the Republican Party now firmly stands for the interests of the top 1%, period, full stop. And tragically, as Thomas Frank points out in his book, Listen Liberal, the Democratic Party officially largely stands for the interests of the top 10% of Americans. Now, the Democratic Party is expanding that. You know, the Bernie-crats, they're taking it out to the bottom 99%. But the Republican Party has no interest in that, no intention of doing that, won't ever do that. And that's what we need to be pointing out to people. Will, thanks for the call. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wasn't that fascinating, the Raven Rock book? I mean, it's like, whoa. They're like dead serious about being ready for a nuclear war. And the fact that every president before Trump has actually gone out and looked at these facilities and come back saying, this is not good. We should not have a nuclear war. And Trump has not, at least as far as we know. Well, I mean, you know, I guess he goes to his clubs and he watches women's tennis tournaments. But I've said it before, I'll say it again. I don't believe that Donald Trump ever wanted to be president. In fact, I believe that he declared his candidacy for president as a way of sticking his thumb in the eye of NBC, because they were talking about not renewing his contract with Celebrity Apprentice, which was a big deal for him. Celebrity Apprentice was a real important part of his life. It was he had finally hit the big time. He was on the big network, on the big, you know, not just cable. He was all over the country. It was a big deal. And NBC pulled that rug out from underneath him, and suddenly he was just another real estate developer, whatever in Manhattan. And that's not enough. So he ran for president, but I don't think that he ever had any intention of, number one, even winning the Republican primary. I mean, he kept saying things that conventional wisdom said, you know, if you attack John McCain for not being a war hero in the Republican Party, in a Republican primary, you're going to lose. So he attacks John McCain for not being a war hero. If you tell people that, the 50-year Republican support of free trade agreements, I mean, this is a phrase that was invented by Richard Nixon. The Constitution says that if the United States engages into a trade agreement with any other foreign country, that's called a treaty, and it requires two-thirds of the Senate to approve it. Well, that's really hard to get two-thirds of a vote. So Richard Nixon came up with this idea of, we won't call them treaties, we'll call them trade agreements. And, you know, so it'll just be a simple majority in the House and the Senate. And, you know, let's pass some legislation authorizing this. And they did. And so ever since Nixon, we've had these crazy trade deals, and it's always been Republicans promoting them. But Donald Trump said, no, this is in the Republican primary. He's like, no, these trade deals suck. And every Republican was up there going, yeah, you know, TPP, trade deals, we love this stuff. And Donald Trump was like, no, it's terrible stuff. You would think that in a Republican primary, that would get you disqualified, right? Trump, you know, he talks about, I could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, nothing would happen. You had the whole, you know, crotch grabbing thing that was exposed. I mean, obviously Trump didn't want that to come out, but it did come out. And his Rudy Giuliani and the others came out and defended him for it. He never wanted to be president. And it's fairly obvious to me that he doesn't want to be president right now. I mean, he's loving the pomp and circumstance. He loved going to France and, you know, walking at the head of a parade with Macron. He loved going to Saudi Arabia and having a whole, you know, doing the sword dance and holding the golden orb, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But sit down and actually read a policy paper. He doesn't even know what's in his what's in the Republican health care, so-called health care plans. He doesn't know. He didn't know the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. This is a guy who never had any real interest in being president other than just wanting to say, hey, I'm the president. Right? Which he keeps saying, you know, I'm the president, you're not. And that's really it. And his lack of ability to take seriously what is arguably the most important job in the world, certainly the most important job in America, or one of the most important jobs in America, his inability or unwillingness to take this seriously, particularly when it comes to things like nuclear war, this should scare the hell out of all of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Back with your calls, Ed.
All the important stories we cover and the issues we care about are at HartmanReport.com. Members of our community can comment and join the conversation.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Love your show. I just need to make a little correction. I heard you talking about...
Hey, Paul, can you take me off speakerphone, please?
One second. How's that, Tom?
That's a lot better. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that.
Okay.
You were talking about free trade and that Republicans are always the one that are engaging in it.
Yeah, the single exception to that was PNTR with China.
Okay.
Which is not technically a trade agreement.
All right. I could have sworn I heard you say that's why I got my phone so fast. Is, you know, President Obama spent 8 years crafting in private and secrecy the TPP.
Right.
And I think the only reason it got shot down is the same reason they're trying to shoot down Obamacare. It's just because the African-American guy did it.
Hmm.
These are Republican ideas, including Obamacare, which I'm no fan of.
Yeah. Yeah. It is entirely probable that you're right. You know, and Obamacare, I think even more than trade, is a classic example of that. Mitt Romney actually, you know, very methodically, Mitt Romney introduced Romney Care to Massachusetts in 2000 because he planned to run for president. And this was going to be his signature achievement. It was going to be his grand accomplishment that he had taken the Heritage Foundation's plan and put it into place in Massachusetts, and it worked. You can have for-profit companies providing health insurance to people and you know, with some state subsidies and make it all work. And, then the Republicans hate it now, even though it's their legislation, because it was done by our nation's first black president, or because it was done by a Democrat. Take your choice. I'm inclined to agree with your opinion that race plays a role in it, Paul.
Yeah.
So,
okay, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Linda in Stephenson, Virginia. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm well. What's up?
About an hour and a half, man. I just love this. I'm actually a Virginia resident, but I live extremely close to the West Virginia line by 4 miles. So I have lots of friends in West Virginia. So this morning, we went up to Capito's office to support those folks. And we actually had an amazing time. We got there at about 9 o'clock. There was no information on her. We met with staff.
Now, if I may, Linda, you're talking about Shelley Moore Capito, who is one of the two senators, along with Joe Manchin from West Virginia. She's a Republican.
So everybody knows what we're talking about here.
Continue.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's good.
Yeah, I just kind of assume everybody knows what's going on in my neck of the woods. But anyway, we went up there. We had our protest. We had our sign. They must have had 40 people show up. They actually had the West Virginia Journal come in. Folks went upstairs. I'm not a resident. I couldn't go up to meet with her. But anyway, staff was there to meet a a conference room, the staff member actually came down and addressed the entire group, you know, announcing that Capito is not in favor of straight repeal. She will vote against that.
What?
Yes, it was the staff member came down and met with us resistors, the indivisible groups from West Virginia, Jefferson County, and us representing other individual groups. It was a fantastic experience. All I really want to say is that I've been involved with the indivisible groups. I'm working, I'm calling, I'm showing up at protests. I'm doing everything that I can do as a recovering Republican. And it's a process that has empowered all of us. And I just hope more people get on that train, because this administration has to hear us and feel us at every opportunity.
And it's remarkable, Linda, that you're able, that your group and groups like yours have been able to counter the power of literally hundreds of millions of dollars that the health insurance companies, the big pharmaceutical companies, the for-profit hospitals have been pouring into this city in lobbying and campaign contributions. And you know, they're having to recognize the will of the people. It's a really remarkable thing. Linda, if you don't mind my asking, you said you're a recovering Republican. Would you care to share that story with us?
Oh, my gosh. I have a story. I've been a recovering Republican for a very long time, so that sounds like I just flipped. My mother was working on Nixon's reelection campaign for the, you know, second term. I have three brothers that were over in Vietnam. Needless to say, she and I disagreed. And that's when I got empowered to start figuring this out. Now, I did vote for Ford. I have voted for Frank Wolf, which was a representative here in the Virginia 10th congressional district.
Right.
But
Jerry Ford was not a terrible guy, by the way.
Excuse me?
Jerry Ford was not a terrible guy. I mean, he represented Grand Rapids, Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. I was familiar with Jerry Ford. I have friends of my family who knew Jerry Ford. And, as a president, he was kind of, you know, milk toast. But as a human being, he was a decent human being. You know, compared to Richard Nixon, certainly, and policy-wise, compared to Reagan and Bush and Trump, he was a saint. Forgive my interrupting your story, Linda.
No. It's all of our story, actually. You know.
But, yeah.
You know, that's kind of what it was. Nixon, the whole bit. I was a girl who couldn't even vote. I was 17. I was working against my mother, protesting. My father gave me $500 and a car, and I went from Tennessee up to Washington, D.C., and I mean, that's just where it all got invigorated. So I've always kind of been an activist, but I certainly have been a moderate voter. In fact, I've held elective office as an independent locally because I was not a Democrat. Okay. And in Red Virginia, you're toast. I mean, let's be serious. You're just absolute toast. So I ran as an independent. I had to get more signatures. It was much harder. I defeated the Republican who had been in for 16 years. But, you know, I'm really comfortable on this side. I love being a resistor. I love being an activist. It is so much fun. And, you know, being a somewhat of a policy wonk, it's very exciting. I just want to encourage people that if you don't think your voice matters, stop the nonsense. Get involved. Get off the sofa. Get behind the keyboard. If you can't do that, keep writing the letters, making the calls. Do whatever you physically can do, but make noise. It's working.
Amen. Amen. Linda, thank you for sharing your story, your general story and your specific story about going to Senator Capito's office and the pep talk. I love it. And thank you for being a progressive activist. God bless you. It's great, great stuff you're doing. Linda, thank you so much for the call. David in Miami Beach, Florida. Hey, David, what's on your mind today? David, you've been on hold for a while. My apologies for that. Thank you. And so maybe you've got me on speakerphone, or it's, I know you're listening to Sirius XM. Maybe the delay will catch up and you can pick up this call. Yes, no, maybe. Okay, David, I'm going to put you on hold and we will come back to you in a minute. And in fact, we're going to hit a break here and we'll pick up more phone calls after this. So stick around. We're coming up on, what is it? 42 minutes past the hour, to the second. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls and my thoughts on all of the above.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out my article today on Alternet.org. A 21st century form of indentured servitude has already penetrated deep into the American heartland. You can post comments on it. We'll be back. And welcome back. Kim in Portland, Oregon, listening on X-Ray FM. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was last on your program in December offering to teach my small business gentle disposition to any nonprofit that will create a worker-owned cooperative.
I remember.
And gentle disposition helps families who've lost a loved one take care of the belongings they left behind or clear their home. Mm-hmm. So I've yet to get a taker, and I'm now expanding my offer to any group that will build a worker-owned cooperative, and I'm also adding several other viable business ideas that I'm willing to teach to groups that create a worker-owned cooperative.
Okay.
One of these services is called Therapeutic Messages, and I help people figure out what they need to say to address difficult situations. And I have a blog, and my most recent post is titled, A Therapeutic Message to America, Steal These Business Ideas, Please. So I'm making all my ideas, including therapeutic messages and gentle disposition, free for stealing, but I'm also offering free coaching to any group that will build a worker-owned cooperative because I'm super passionate about promoting the growth of worker-owned cooperatives.
Wow, that's great. So say I had a friend who had some serious health problems and also had problems at work as a consequence of that, maybe lost his or her job or ended up with a worse job. How do you therapeutically intervene in your mind, Kim?
Well, a therapeutic message is intended for people who have a problem that they're struggling to figure out how to address. So I help people figure out what they need to say in a difficult situation.
So it wouldn't be for me to say, it would be for my friend to say to himself? Is that what you're talking about?
Or for your friend to say to address that situation of being laid off or losing their job potentially before losing their job. So a therapeutic message is really for anybody who's in a difficult situation where they understand what their problem is, but they're not sure how to address it.
Right.
So I work with people to help. It's filling a very specific niche.
So let me give you a very, I'm curious what this means, because this all, you know, we're speaking in generalities.
Okay.
I have a friend who had a heart attack and lost his job. And I don't remember which happened first, but they were both within about a 3-month period. And he's having a real hard time right now. He's, you know, he's in his 60s and it's, or 50s, I'm not sure. It's somewhere in that range. And, you know, it's tough to get a job under those circumstances. What should I say, in your opinion?
Does your friend have ability to take on something new, or are they in the midst of despair over the loss of their job and their house?
Well, he hasn't lost his house, and he's got a lot of abilities.
Okay. Well, what you might say is actually point them over to my blog, and they can review the different business ideas that I'm offering, and perhaps one of those might be something that they could take on. There's no charge for them.
Right. But you don't have... you're not suggesting specific words or a frame or something like that?
That's actually the opposite. What I do is I take someone who's in a quandary and I help them figure out what their message is. So I'm not actually supplying the messages. I'm helping people figure out what do they need to say for their own therapeutic relief.
I see. Okay. And the website is?
Well, my blog is called The Crash and Burn Survival Guide, How to Find Heaven by Walking Through Hell. And the latest blog post is A Therapeutic Message to America. Steal These Business Ideas, Please.
Okay, great. Kim, thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. Thanks for listening to X-Ray FM. We'll be right back. Stick around. It's 46 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So I have employees who are getting their health insurance through the Obamacare exchange here in Washington, D.C. I have friends who got health insurance through Obamacare exchanges. I have friends who got health care through Medicaid expansion. Donald Trump is now saying, we're going to let Obamacare fail. That any news media that lets him say we're going to let it fail without pointing out that a year and a half ago, Marco Rubio passed legislation to damage Obamacare, doing away with the so-called risk corridors. Any media that doesn't mention that, and that Donald Trump is withholding payments or has been threatening to withhold payments to the insurance companies for the Obamacare subsidies, is committing journalistic malpractice. He's not going to let Obamacare die. He's going to kill it. And the Republicans have been working on this for 2 years since they've had power, the ability to do it since Rubio put in this place. And again, I just Google Marco Rubio and risk corridors. New York Times article comes right up at the top. And in fact, I retweeted it this morning. You know, just look it up and you'll see these guys are hell-bent for leather on destroying the Affordable Care Act and then saying to the Democrats, well, what are you going to do now? This is getting ugly. This is getting very ugly. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, Tom. Well, it's about the Affordable Care Act. My head is exploding. Of course, you probably know about this, that President Trump all of a sudden says he's not going to take ownership of this, and neither is the Republican Party.
Right.
He's just going to let Obamacare die, and he's going to throw and let the Democrats come to us for help. In other words, throw it in our ball court, not be responsible for anything, like everything that the Republicans get themselves into. They're never held accountable. But what really gets me, got Mitch McConnell up there saying in 2015, here we go again, blaming the Democrats, 2015, we put in the bill, repeal and replace, he said, and President Obama, he vetoed the bill. He says it would have given us 2 years. He said that would have bill that would have given us 2 years to do something about this. But then he doesn't go on to say about replacing it. What would he have replaced it with at the time for the during the 2 years' time? What if we were to repeal it then? He doesn't go on to say that. None of these Republicans are ever being questioned by the news media, none of them. And I'm just so furious about this whole thing. And if we lose this election in 2018, if we don't get the House or the Senate back or both, I am walking away from the Democratic Party. I can't stand their silence all the time. They seem to run away. They're like roaches. They run and hide when the light turns.
It is not that Donald
speaking out.
Donald, let me recalibrate this. It is not that the Democratic Party is not speaking out. Chuck Schumer, Debbie Stabenow, certainly the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Mark Pocan, Raul Grijalva, Keith Ellison, all of these folks. And I mentioned Debbie Stabenow because I know that she just did this in the last day or two. They're all holding press conferences regularly. I mean, like weekly at the very least, and sometimes every other day or so. And the thing is that the media refuses to cover it. The media only covers the things that have to do with Republicans. And it's a disaster for the United States. But the media, the corporate media in this country is threatened and rightly so, feels threatened by particularly the more progressive part of the Democratic Party. And they do not want to go back to the days before Ronald Reagan when the Sherman Antitrust Act was actually being enforced, because the media has become as much of a monopoly as any other industry in the United States now. And that's what's going on. It's not that the Democratic Party isn't doing a lot, a hell of a lot. It's that it is not getting reported on, and even on the so-called liberal network. And that is very, very troubling. Donald, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. David in Miami Beach. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hi, North Miami Beach. Thanks for being on YouTube. Yes, I decided
my pleasure.
Non-compete clause as a security guard. I was hired as a mid-level dispatcher. Then they downsized me and eventually fired me from the wrong job. But that's okay because they had to pay me, forced to do back pay.
Right. But yes, you had to sign a non-compete clause so you couldn't go to work for another security firm?
I keep trying and no one's doing it. It's not helping.
Yeah, so other companies don't want to hire you because they're afraid of being sued by your previous employer?
Right. In theory, they could, and definitely I could.
Right.
But the fact I was forced to, they had to give me back pay for some other reason, it's called comfort.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Out of work for almost a year, and they give me maybe 1 month's pay. So, ironically, it gave me time to be a poll worker, but things have not been fun.
Yeah. No, right. it's a tough one.
And I have college degrees and stuff, but it's not helping.
Yeah. Yeah, we have not really recovered from the great Republican crash of 2008. And for that matter, we haven't recovered from the damage that Reaganomics has inflicted on the middle class of America. We've
Exactly. I went from being paid $8.01 to being paid $8 an hour in 2014. How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah. And all right. that time, there's been 2 or 3% per year inflation for everything, and 6 to 7% per year inflation for medical things. David, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Professor.
Yeah. Good talking to you. Thank you. Joe in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I was listening to the show yesterday, and you used the term Trump chumps a couple of times. And I got to be honest with you, I cringed at it, only because I love your show. I've been listening to it for a few months, and it's so clear and smart and intelligent. And I would just hate for your opponents, our opponents, to be able to use those kind of sound bites to divide wedges between us and the Bernie supporters who, and believe me, I could care less about their feelings, and I share the sentiment, but, you know, the Bernie supporters that voted for Trump, and I don't know what percentage of them made up, you know, his vote total, 5%, 10%, 15%, maybe you know what it is, but you're just too valuable in your position and with your intelligence and your platform to allow opponents to use that kind of rhetoric. Maybe I'm being naive. Maybe I'm being a little too presumptuous, but it just concerned me a little bit. Love you.
Thank you, Joe. Your comments are taken seriously. And yeah, I generally don't do ad hominems and let me think about it. But thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. I heard everything you said. Barb in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hey, Barb, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to call to comment on the non-compete clause you referred to at the very beginning of the show, and I know another gentleman just did. I signed a non-compete clause when I began dog walking for a home dog walking business, and this would have been about 19 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm still a dog walker, and I was let go by this company a year ago. But about 3 years ago, I realized that as an independent contractor, that doesn't fly. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but if you're an independent contractor, so a lot of people in computer sciences, we're now being let go as full-time workers and being hired back as independent contractors. A lot of companies were doing this, big companies.
Right.
And they were doing this in order to save money, of course, on benefits and paying into Social Security and everything. So that meant very much.
So are you saying that that non-competes cannot apply to independent contractors? I thought you could basically organize anything that is contractually legal.
Well, you can, but it's very specific, and I'm not going to go into it because I know you don't have much time, but for an independent contractor, for you to have an independent contractor that you treat like an employee, in other words, if you give them a schedule, you tell them where to be and when to be there, then you are actually treating them like an employee.
Well, you're also breaking labor law if you do that.
Right. So if you're treating them like an employee, but you're having them sign an independent contractor clause, which does apply to employees, they are no longer an independent contractor. You can be sued because you did not pay into Social Security and you take taxes out.
Workman's comp and everything else, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I finally told my boss this. The woman I called my boss, but she was really the woman I contracted with several years ago. I said, you know, I don't think you should have me sign this because it can come back and bite you in the butt. So that was when I no longer had to sign one. But it was a 2-year non-compete clause. And because I walk dogs for people, that's my job. So many dogs either move out of the area or die in 2 years.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily, you know, the 2 years really puts a dent in. And I wasn't supposed to contract anywhere in the area that she was in, which was pretty much a 10-mile radius around my house.
Amazing. Barb, I got to run, but thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Thanks for listening to WCPT. That's fascinating. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. We've heard this somewhere before. Where's that?
Democracy is not a spectator sport.
I knew I'd heard it somewhere before. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.